This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello and welcome to Conversations with the Voice of Reason. I'm your host, Benjamin Boyce, and today's conversant is Maya Forstatter. This is her first long-form interview with a podcaster of such renown as I, or any podcaster for that matter. And so what we do actually is dive into her past year and a half or 2 years of speaking about sex and gender on the internet and then being met with repercussions in her professional life. Very fascinating individual. I hope that this does give some insight into her personal views and her personality for those who are interested and curious as to what is the big deal with Maya Forstatter. Well, I'll let you guys figure that out for yourselves. So without further ado, here is Maya. You came onto my radar when there's this tweet, like this very funny little tweet that this author named J.K. Rowling published on December 19th of 2019. Yeah, J.K. Rowling Day. And the reason why I know the date of this tweet is because this tweet, for some reason, is capped, or Twitter has decided to manipulate how this tweet is viewed. And so every year now, it's kind of a tradition to go around and blast from the mountaintop that this tweet isn't... is deleting likes. There's something funny about this particular tweet.
We don't know how many millions of people really, really know the tweet.
Yeah. But what's suspect about it is because Twitter seems to have a very specific relationship with one portion of their audience and seems to come down on the side of this one portion of their audience, which would be the trans rights kind of contingent of the Twitter discourse. And part of my investigation is watching how that that portion of Twitter interacts and has power over other portions of it. But that is reflected in society at large. And your case, or the substance of J.K. Rowling's tweet, was about a case that you were involved in, which comes down to like the way that your expression of opinion on Twitter affected your daily life. Do you want to do some sketching of that and then get into your core beliefs and where we're at right now in this discourse, and then with your story?
Yeah, sure. So October 2018 was sort of where I think my story starts, which was the UK government was consulting on the Gender Recognition Act. They had taken up this proposal to go for self-ID, so to move from a system where there's some medical gatekeeping and where they were allowing a very small number of people to change their legal sex to something which could have sort of opened it up to 100 times as many people with much, well, sort of no criteria at all, really, just on the basis of self-declaration. And I was on Twitter. I was working for a think tank, Washington DC based think tank, but I was in the London office working on international tax policy. And so this is not my area, but I'm a feminist.
And you feminists, you're like in every industry.
Funny that.
Wherever particular women congregate.
I'm a feminist, but you know, I'm also my original degree was in agriculture, so you know, kind of underlying, if you think about the hierarchy of different beliefs that you have about the world, my underlying belief is about evolutionary biology and about science, and then my feminism kind of sits somewhere on top of that, you know, somewhere on top of making a good society with rules that work for most people. And I think, you know, the how you get to that is up for debate, but it needs to be up for debate. And if people are forced to say things that are not true, you know, it breaks all our institutions. It breaks our sense-making institutions and our democratic institutions and sort of in the hierarchy of things that are broken, I think, you know, that sort of sits fairly fairly near the front for me. So, yeah, in 2018, I kind of started paying a little bit more attention to this debate, mainly on Twitter, you know, sort of seeing what was going on, seeing, you know, and at first thinking, I support trans rights, I support everyone's human rights, I'm not a religious conservative, I'm you know, I, like many people, I kind of saw this as being like gay rights. And then seeing things like when women started meeting to talk about the Gender Recognition Act and the issues around it, the protests and the attacks that they got. And there was one where one of the early meetings they tried to organise, so they booked it at Millwall Football Ground, which is, Millwall is a football club whose slogan is "No one likes us, we don't care." They have a conference centre, and so they booked a room in this conference centre, thinking, well, Millwall is used to dealing with crowd control. They shouldn't have a problem with us. And once they had advertised that this event was going on, the football club started getting calls, you know, don't hire this room out to these terrible fascist, horrible Nazi women. So they lost that booking, and then they went to have another meeting somewhere else. So they met at Speaker's Corner in the centre of London to, you know, not give out the address. And there were counter-protesters there, and there were attacks. And so I saw these videos on YouTube, you've probably seen them, where an older woman is attacked by what looks like a young man. And then we're told that this is a woman, you know, that this is not a woman being attacked by a man. She has to see that person as a woman. And, you know, you look at the video and it looks like what it is, which is male violence against women. And if you can't use the words to talk about that, then if you can't use words to describe reality, then how can you have any kind of fairness or justice?
Yeah, and discerning patterns and having a very frank discussion about certain trends in
right,
society.
Exactly. So that was kind of what started to wake me up to thinking this was not what I thought it was. And so I followed it for probably about a year of kind of paying attention, up to the point in, I think, September 2018, when I thought, I need to speak up about this. I could see other women being brave, and I thought they were, you know, I sort of admired them for being brave. And then I thought, well, you know, I had at the time 2,000 followers on Twitter, mainly policy wonks, you know, people concerned with international development, economics, tax, but, you know, empirical, not fluffy people. And so I thought, you know, this is a government consultation, we should be able to talk about it. And so I tweeted about it very carefully, and nothing happened. Nobody responded, nobody said I was wrong, nobody said I was right. They just, it was like, you know, tumbleweed. And that went on
a tumble tweet.
Yes, a tumble tweet, you know. You know, community where normally if I tweet about something, people would tell me I'm wrong or tell me I'm right.
Okay.
Or, you know.
So you're in a community of vigorous exchange of ideas.
Exactly. And, you know, nobody was saying anything. And so I tweeted a few things. I tweeted about Karen White, the trans woman who sexually assaulted a woman in prison, a woman's prison in the UK. You know, there were things going on in the news, and I tweeted about them, and each time there was nothing. And so then I decided to set a direct question to my followers. And so in international development, a lot of blokes, a lot of guys in international development have taken this pledge not to be on a manual. So that means if you're invited to speak at a conference and it's all guys on the panel, you say to the conference organizer nicely, can you find a woman? And I will step down if you want, or you can make the panel bigger, or, but, you know, surely you can find a woman who can speak on this topic. Have you thought about that? And so I thought, you know, these issues about prisons, about safeguarding, about, you know, the census, they're all things that people can kind of say, well, that's not my business, I don't have to think about that. But I thought, if I asked them a direct question about something that they had to make a decision about, where they had taken a personal policy decision to say, I'm going to do this for women, what do they then define women as? And there was this guy, Pips Philip Bunce, who works at Credit Suisse, the finance, big finance company, who had been given this award. He was on a list for 100 women in business. And Pips, or Philip Bunce, goes to work sort of 4 days a week, dressed as a man. He's a married man with children and a wife. And sort of on a Friday, he goes to work in a wig and a dress, and he takes the name Pips Bunce. And he's been sort of celebrated for this by the LGBTQI++ networks in business. And he was, you know, given this FT award for women in business. And that obviously made the newspapers. And I thought that was quite obscene. And so I clipped a picture of Pips Bunce and said, if you were on a panel with Pips Bunce, would you still say, this is a man, or, you know, you need to have a woman on there? And it got discussion. So over the course of kind of a week, there were, you know, a few hundred tweets between, you know, threaded conversations between me and other people. And people who, you know, just very hard-nosed economists, empirical people saying, well, if he thinks he's a woman or she's a woman part of the time, who am I to say that she's not? And I was really surprised that, you know, people were saying that.
Well, you said that was obscene. Could you expand on that? Like, what's obscene about a man being a woman one day a week?
What's obscene, I mean, not what he's wearing, but the fact that when you're giving an award for women in business to try and reflect the fact that women are underrepresented in finance and in the city. So that, in fact, on this list, there were three cross-dressing males. So they weren't even men who identified as women. They were just men who come to work.
Appropriated woman
face.
Yeah,
or, you know, come to work some days dressed in a dress. And that, you know, to take your program that was there to address an underrepresentation of women and to then use it to celebrate cross-dressing males just seemed to me, you know, it's all of this stuff, like International Women's Day is about having, you know, having one day when you can talk about women, and even on that one day now it's all about trans women or women, or, you know, any sort of program or law or policy that's there to protect women is now being used to say, you know, you can't be part of this unless you accept that trans women are women, and even that Pips Bunce is a woman on a Friday and not the rest of the week. So yeah, that was kind of where that started. And then obviously, because there was this long conversation with lots of threaded tweets, which obviously I didn't realize, but sort of rang some bells in Washington, D.C., in the headquarters of the organization that I worked for. And I got an email that said, we ask our staff and associates to not use exclusionary language, and can you put a disclaimer on your tweets? Because it was my personal Twitter account, but obviously I work in a field where, you know, you talk about policy and work stuff mixed in with your personal account. And so I did. I said, yes, I'll put a disclaimer on my tweets, but also definitions are exclusionary by definition. You know, if you're going to talk about men and women and the things that affect them, you have to define that group, and that means excluding some people from that group. And, you know, in international development, you know, you talk about maternal mortality and early marriage, children, you know, girls leaving school, what this does to their educational and earning, you know, and their power in society. It's all about sex. And so, you know, I sort of at that point still thought that the organization would say, fine. And they're also an organization that doesn't take organizational positions, that allows people, you know, is happy for people to disagree within the organization as long as they do it with evidence and argument. That's what a think tank is there for.
And in your experience, was this the one issue where no debate? Is this particular about this issue where it was a sacred cow or something that you couldn't touch? Are there other issues that? Or?
I think there probably are, but I tripped this particular wire.
Okay.
And also I was sitting in London, you know, mainly talking to people in London and not people in Washington. And I think I didn't realize quite how sensitive it would be in Washington. I think in London, you know, there was much more sort of openness within the office for talking about, you know, all kinds of things. And I sort of at that point hadn't realized quite what was, you know, what the situation was like in US institutions. So, you know, I really did think that they were going to say, you know, I was happy to say this is something that I'm concerned about in my personal, private and political life. It's not something that I'm working on. I can separate those two things out, but I didn't think that they would come down on me in the way that they did. I mean, this is an organization, the chair of the board in the US is Larry Summers, who, you know, Larry Summers knows what a woman is, and, you know, he's been cancelled for for talking about biology. You know, so I know there are people who, you know, I think probably the majority of people agree with me, but obviously there were young people in the office in Washington who were offended.
Okay, so your feeling or your intuition is that there's kind of a generational gender conformity that's occurring around this particular topic. Or is this something new that's rising up into older institutions?
Yes, I think older institutions know that they have a problem. You know, they have a problem of old white men at the, you know, old upper class white men at the top of the organization, and they recognize that that's a problem. And then they have young, diverse, you know, women coming in at the bottom of the organization. And, you know, so I think they know they have a problem about diversity, and then they don't know how to deal with it. And then when something like this comes up and the people who are raising the concerns are young, diverse women, you know, the old men at the top of the organization don't feel like they can defend either the ideals and the ideas or, you know, the women who disagree. And so, you know, I think they're very fragile, you know, they're very vulnerable to those kind of attacks. And then obviously, you know, we see the same thing happening on race in these institutions. But, you know, the thing that I have focused on is sex and women, partly because I think it's so fundamental, and I think it's something that we can win, particularly in the UK, in terms of pushing back against, you know, the sort of tide of irrationality. So it seems like it's something that's worth doing on this issue in the UK, and that might make a difference internationally. You know, if people can see that you can bring clarity and you can bring sanity back into this area, then maybe it can help us to find ways of doing it in other places, doing it in other topics where the, you know, kind of identity politics has taken over from rationality.
So there is a, it seems like you're okay with a certain level of identity politic, but there's some place where identity politic gets unstable or it gets untethered to rationality or reality. And what you were saying is that there's a problem with old white men at the top. That is a problem in some respects. So you think that they're susceptible to identity politic, but they're just deferring to these diverse people on the bottom in all of their demands because they can't actually pinpoint what the issue is with old white men being at the top of these power structures. To what degree can we start to change the old white man trope without it completely cascading into a free-for-all of intersectional, oppression Olympics or identity-based validity and invalidity?
I think that's why you've got to look at why, the problem is not old white men, because, young white men become old white men, and it's not their fault.
Looking forward to it.
Yes, exactly. it's kind of, where are the women? Where are the people of color? Why are the people who come through university and get hired not reflected at the top of these organizations? And is that a question of just time, time passing through, or are there specific barriers to people advancing? And it's really clear with women that there's a barrier, and the barrier is to do with having children, pregnancy, childbirth, rearing children, and it's to do with how organizations are built for dads with stay-at-home mothers, or with mothers who are, doing kind of secondary jobs, so that, to get to the top of your career, you have to be like a dad. You have to, put your family, you just have to have a lot of support in raising your family. And if you don't have that, then you fall off the track. So all of the stuff where people are talking about gender as a once you start talking about gender discrimination and you don't talk about sex, you're erasing that whole side of sex is about reproduction. Reproduction has social
consequences,
and if society is not built to allow women to raise a family and stay in a career, then, you will keep having they may not be white, they may be different, but you will keep having men at the top of these organizations because women have stepped off and not been able to get back on because it was never built to enable them to do that. Mm-hmm. It's not just about organizations, it's about, how you build cities. So, people, you have a child, you have a second child, you can't afford to live in the center of the city, the schools are not good, you move out to the suburbs, suddenly you have a hour and a half commute back to work, and it doesn't make sense for both parents to do that commute. So you have women doing jobs that are, geographically constrained by being able to do childcare, where the dads are on airplanes and organizations separate those roles. As long as you don't talk about sex, you only talk about gender, you make all of that invisible.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So when gender comes and the erosion of female as a class, and it starts in these awards, it starts in these conversations where what you can and cannot say and what topic you can't challenge, push back on, that whole part of the conversation about sex-based rights and the design of cities and the design of businesses around or the consequence of reproduction and its impact on our material world gets swept away, and therefore gets swept away decades and decades of work by women for women to establish all these different rights or these accommodations. And so we're beyond even the bathroom or the sports discussion. We're talking about the actual material differences in income and mobility for women that's also being impacted just strictly by the conversation changing.
And the way you collect statistics in order to be to understand that and to look at the patterns, and then the language to be able to talk about it.
In what way are the statistics changing?
Well, so in the UK, we've just had the census. We've just had our 10-year census, and there was a big battle over the sex question. So the census since 1920, before that, in fact, has always asked about sex, and the answer was male or female. So you have this long time series data where you can understand something about what life is like for men or women. And they added a gender identity question, which is fine. They added a question about, is your gender identity different from the sex that was registered at birth, to try and understand how many people identify as transgender, which is fine. That's a separate category. But then the Office for National Statistics also wanted to give guidance on the sex question, to say people could answer it according to any official document. So you can already change the sex on your driver's license just by writing to the driving license authority, and you can change the sex on your passport by having a doctor's note. And the doctor's note is not a diagnosis, it's just you've gone to your doctor and said, can you write this note? And so basically they were saying self-ID on the census, and that would mean that you don't have clear categories, you don't have it's not aligned with the historical record, and you end up having two gender questions and no sex question. And the Office for National Statistics they've been thinking about this for a long time, and they'd been consulting, but they had basically written off what the gender critical women had told them and were going with what the trans activist lobby had told them, which was, it's offensive to ask people their sex. And so they underestimated what women would do. And when they published this guidance, we raised between us £100,000 in 3 days and took them to court and won.
Oh,
Yeah, we won. Well, not me, but I'm sort of
The GC lobby. I didn't know you guys were that deadly.
I hope they learned not to mess. We took them to court on a judicial review. It was fair play for women that did it, backed by lots of women putting in their £20, and said, it's not in the mandate of the Office for National Statistics to redefine what sex is. They have to follow the law, and the law says sex is what it says on your birth certificate. And there's still a question of, should that have been what it said on your birth certificate when you were born versus what it says now, which you can change. But what they took out was, you can answer it with what it says on your library card or your passport. So it was a big victory, and the Office for National Statistics had just thought, well, these women are not gonna do anything, so they had to defend what they were doing in court, and the judge was not impressed, and I think we're going to have to do quite a lot of that to bring brings this stuff into the sunlight, and it says, you have to defend what you're doing. It has to be in line with the law. You have to, as a government entity, you're there to serve everyone, not a very small lobby group. And so, yeah. And obviously the categories that the census uses then get picked up by other institutions. They all will use the same definition, so it's important to to be able to say sex matters. We need to collect the data on it. So
it seems like there's a lot of lawfare that's going on in the UK specifically. I know it's happening over here, but I've run into a lot of different cases, and you also have a case, and
So going back to my story, so I lost my job over the course of about 6 months. It was a job that was, I was a visiting fellow with a consultancy contract, and I was working with them to raise money to do, we developed this big project. I'd written part of the proposal. We put the proposal into a big foundation, and the idea was when we get the money, they would then hire me to do the bit of work that I designed with them. And so over the course of sort of 6 months, that bits of that offer were taken away until at the end, the whole offer was taken away. And at the same time, they investigated me. So there were no formal complaints against me. There were two women in Washington who sort of raised concerns. And the organization said they wanted to think about academic freedom and kind of how they manage academic freedom in this age of offense taking, and they thought I would be a good case for that. So they hired a diversity and inclusion consultancy to sort of look at my tweets and tell them what, you know, whether
interpret them,
whether what, yes, interpret them and help them to think about academic freedom. And I think really they were just kind of deferring judgment. You know, they didn't want to look at what I'd said and say, well, this isn't transphobic. It's not transphobic to say that transsexual, male to female transsexual is not the same as a woman, is somebody who has rights, and we need to think about how those rights should be secured in society. But that's a different life situation to being female, of being a woman, and just saying that is not in any in any rational world, that's not transphobic. But as we know, we're not in that world. And I think they looked at my tweets, and they didn't want to make that judgment themselves, so they hired this diversity inclusion consultancy who said that my tweets were exclusionary and hurtful and all of that.
It's baked in that they deferred to somebody who would say it for them. Some sort of inquisitor class trots in and says, yes, I can verify that this is hateful and bigoted and toxic.
Because I think that the people, people within the organization don't want to say, well, actually, yeah, I agree, male and female are two different things, because then they know that, the finger will be pointed at them. So, you bring in an expert, like a witch finder. They did this investigation, and because I wasn't on a long-term contract, they didn't go through any formal process. They just, in the end, sort of, as I say, removed each bit of this offer until there wasn't an offer left. And so then I they turned off my emails and said, thank you very much, goodbye. And that was March, or just before March 6th, 2019, International Women's Day, and I'd been writing this article for International Women's Day, so I published it on Medium, and I tweeted it, and I tweeted a thread about it, and in that thread I said that I'd lost my job, and I didn't, I thought it was a lost cause. I wasn't thinking at that point that there was anything that could be done about it, but I just wanted to document that had happened. And the feminist lawyers arrived like the fairy godmothers.
Oh yeah. Okay. So they're already, could we just tug something apart?
Yep.
It was at will employment. The company that hired you could let you go for any reason.
Well, it wasn't so much that I was on a fixed term, basically consultancy contract. Yeah. but we'd been working together on a proposal with the idea, you know, with the idea that when, you know, this proposal had my CV on it, it had my work in the proposal, and so the idea was when we got the money, they would then hire me to do the work. And so I think being a US organization, they probably thought that's, I have no employment rights, and I didn't know whether I, you know, I had no idea about these things. But so, what I was later told was in the UK, you have employment rights in the same way that, you know, Uber, they, you know, there's been a big, or not exactly the same, but, you know, there's a big, been a big case about Uber drivers. Are they self-employed or do they have some rights? So it's a, it's a spectrum between being an employee and being self-employed. And I was somewhere
but
on that spectrum.
The work you were doing, so on one level, you were on this contract that would be renewed or not renewed. But what the work you were actually doing under that contract was building up to even more work that you were intimately involved with this longer term project. Okay.
Yeah.
And so your contribution to that was revoked.
Exactly. Yeah. We got the grant, and they said, actually, we don't want you to do the work. And and obviously that wasn't because of anything other than the fact that I had annoyed people by talking about this subject that you shouldn't talk about.
Well, how to what degree do you know that? It's pretty obvious from you, but was there any documentation of that? And are you able to speak about that?
I can speak about it a little bit in terms of, so when I went, so the case that I've brought is a discrimination case, and it's belief discrimination. So in the UK, you shouldn't be discriminated against at work for, you know, sex, age, disability, race, sexual orientation. There are 9 characteristics, of which one is religion or belief. And the idea is, you know, you shouldn't be discriminated against for being a Muslim. You shouldn't be discriminated against for being an atheist. You shouldn't be discriminated against for being an ex-Muslim. So both belief and lack of belief should not be a reason why you lose your job or are treated badly at work.
Okay.
And so I needed to prove that gender critical feminism, or even sort of, as I said, in the hierarchy, going a bit lower than that, just the belief that sex is real and important, is a philosophical belief. And we also pleaded that there is another belief, the gender ideology belief, that gender, everyone has a gender identity, and that that's more important than sex, is a belief, like a religion, and it's one that I don't share. And so we have 2 claims that, you know, both my belief should be protected and my lack of belief should be protected.
Yeah, you should be protected from somebody else's belief.
Well, no, not so much that you should be protected. You shouldn't lose your job for not having a belief. So if, you know, you shouldn't lose your job for not being a Christian, you shouldn't lose your job for not believing in gender ideology. And we should, you know, have a plural secular society where people can work together. They don't have to share fundamental beliefs. They just have to be tolerant of each other's fundamental beliefs. And so the first part of the case, which is the bit that I lost, was a preliminary hearing on whether my belief is protected, whether this belief is protected. And then the second half of the case, which hasn't been heard yet, which comes to your question, is, was I discriminated against at work? So in answer to your question, that bit hasn't been heard yet, and I probably shouldn't try and litigate it on your podcast.
Fair enough.
But if I win about the belief being protected, then the next stage will be for it to come to court to be heard, you know, each of the stages of how I lost my job, what the investigation was.
Has there been movement toward implementing in law that one's stance towards science is a belief and one's stance towards non-science is a belief? Is that anchored into law yet? Because that seems like weird new territory that just was assumed.
The case law on belief, the set of criteria that you have to meet for your belief to be protected are called the Granger criteria, after this case that was Granger versus Nicholson. And Mr. Nicholson, I think it was, was his belief was climate change. He believed strongly that climate change is, you know, anthropomorphic climate change is real and important, and we have to take urgent action on it. That was his belief. And that was a protected belief. And there were sort of two parts to it. There was the science of it, but there was also the fact that he believed it was important and therefore he wouldn't take flights. It affected his life. So it wasn't just a belief in something that is sort of purely theoretical. It's mm-hmm. a belief that affects your life, and that can be based on science or it can be based on religion or philosophy. And so his case set the criteria, and it's like it has to be coherent, it has to be important, consistent and coherent. Yes, and it has to affect your life. I know, so you know, when we were putting the bundle and the evidence together, I thought the hardest part was showing that the gender ideology was coherent. But, you know, the judge,
I've been
said,
working on that for a while. I can't make
it. And I was looking for, you know, written evidence, like papers from academics to say this is coherent, and you know, it's not very. The judge said he thought I was wrong that there were two sexes. He was quite convinced by chromosome, you know, the confusion between intersex and transgender. He says that in the judgment, but he said, although I was wrong, I was coherent enough. Although he thought I was wrong on that, I didn't fail on that criteria. I failed on the last criteria, which is your belief has to be worthy of respect in a democratic society and not undermine other people's human rights. That was what I failed on. And other beliefs that have failed on that point are Holocaust denial and wanting to overthrow the government by violent revolution. You know, it's not supposed to be a high bar to reach. It's you know, it's the very most egregious things that shouldn't be protected.
But so gender ideology can deny women right to privacy and to women's only spaces and to access to communication. It actively, in practice, gender ideology discriminates openly against women.
Secondarily, there's a difference between what is a protected belief and what you can do with that belief. So if you look at, you know, lots of religious beliefs are very discriminatory, and you know, don't necessarily have a lot to recommend them, but they are beliefs. And then the question is, how much of that belief are you allowed to bring to work? So there are two separate questions. One is your belief protected? And then is if you bring that belief to work, or if that belief constrains how you do your job, is your employer in their rights to get rid of you? And so that second part is still to be heard. But the judge, in my case, he put the two together, and he assumed that I would harass, misgender, be hostile to a transgender colleague or transgender person I met in the workplace. And he said that was intrinsic to my belief, and therefore my belief is not protected.
So intrinsic to the belief in the distinction between male and female is discrimination towards those who change their gender. I'm trying to read into it.
Yeah, because of the way that I had stated
practiced
my belief.
Okay.
Yeah, right. I had practiced it. You know, I said it's not just that I believe that men are male and women are female, but I think it's important that we're able to talk about this. And that, although that doesn't mean, you know, I said that I doesn't mean that I would not respect someone's preferred pronouns at work. I would be doing that as a courtesy to them, not as sharing their belief. And, you know, I think you can work with people that you don't share their belief, but you don't necessarily, you know, attack their religion. You know, ignore the things you disagree on to get on with the things that you need to do together. But the judge thought differently and thought that I was an absolutist and that I would create a hostile workplace.
You come off as pretty... Absolutely.
Yeah, I know. I'm nasty.
You're terribly oppressive in your beliefs.
But you know, if you look at the definition of transphobia that's being put out by, you know, by these organizations, you know, if you look at Human Rights Campaign, you know, what they've said about J.K. Rowling, who is, you know, as reasonable, if not more reasonable than I am, you know, she's dismissed as a terrible transphobe who makes the world a hostile place. So, you know, the judge was not out of line in reflecting that view. That is a view that's held, and he reflected it, but that's not what we don't think that's what the law says in the UK. The law does not reflect the trans activists' definition of transphobia. You know, it respects everybody's rights to freedom of belief and freedom of speech.
And association, yeah.
And association.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just, before we got on, I was on Twitter and just randomly, not having anything to do directly with looking into, like, boning up on your case, like, randomly I come into this account that just hates you. It's like, look at who's replying to Richard Dawkins. And it's just such a weird... That is on Twitter. On Twitter, there is a culture that attacks and assaults somebody who goes against a gender ideology. And they are really strongly against... specifically women who question or criticize gender ideology. And, you know, so that's one thing. And I understand, you know, you can say that that's a world unto itself. But for that to be reflected through Twitter by all these major organizations like the ACLU, the UN Women, blah, 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 then it has an impact on law where it's now shaping policy in a variety of different ways.
And the thing that the judge... and he quotes it in his judgment. The thing that I think influenced his judgment was this thing called the Equal Treatment Bench Book, which is it's not law. It's written by a group of judges, and it's guidance for judges on how to make your courtroom inclusive. And it, you know, it's a good thing. You know, we can go back to old white men, you know, it's sort of, how do you make sure that the courtroom is inclusive to people with disabilities, to people of different races and religions? It, you know, has a chapter on each of them. It's important that they think about this stuff, but the chapter on gender, on transgender, is obviously written and influenced by the trans activist organizations, and it takes a you know, it says you should respect someone's, you know, someone's pronouns, and to the point where, so there was a case recently in the UK of a non-binary man who worked at Jaguar Land Rover, so big car company. He was an engineer and he'd worked there for 20 years. And after 20 years, he decided he was exploring his gender identity and he wanted to come to work some days dressed as a woman and have two different names. So most of the time he was Sean, that was his name. And then sometimes he was Rose. And the company sort of bent over backwards to try and accommodate him, to the point of saying you can use any toilet that you want, even though, you know, on whatever day you choose.
Okay, as long as you're Rose, you can go into the female's bathroom.
No,
but you can't go in there as Sean.
No, they said you could just use... They didn't... You know, similar to what you were saying about my employer, they panicked, right? And they... So they just said, you can use any bathroom. And then he said, well, But then there's a problem, because when I do that, I will get hostile reaction from other staff. And it's like, well, yes, that's why it's not a good idea. He eventually left, and he took his employer to tribunal, and the whole of the judgment is written as Rose. The whole of the judgment is written calling this person she, even when it's talking about the period of time when there were written reports, you know, HR was writing he, but when they repeated that text from the reports into the judgment, they changed it all to she. So they were rewriting, not even just being polite
documents, yeah,
in the current day, but rewriting history in a legal, yeah, yeah, in a legal judgment. And this is because the Equal Treatment Bench Book is telling them to do that. And so then you hear of, as I said, this woman who was attacked at Speaker's Corner. She, her attack was prosecuted for assault, but when she was a witness to that in court, she had to call him she, and she was, although she'd perceived this person to be a man, she'd experienced being attacked physically by a man, she had to say she, and the judge
does that not infringe upon her rights of freedom of speech? Does that not infringe upon the rights of others?
I think it does. I mean, you know, she didn't take it further, so we don't know. And you know, there have been cases of rapists where the judgment is all written in terms of she, but it was a rapist. And even, you know, divorce cases where a woman is divorcing her estranged husband and is forced to call her husband she in court. You know, even where it's been an abusive situation, because this Equal Treatment Bench Book tells the judges that's what they should do. So that, I think, had influenced then, you know, what the judge in my case was thinking about. But that's not law, that's just guidance. And we have this problem in every public institution, that you have these private institutions writing guidance, telling institutions what to do, which is not the law. And in the UK, we have Stonewall. So the big LGBT or originally LGB organisation in the UK, and now almost all about trans, has a programme where big companies, charities, public institutions, you know, pay to be part of their champions programme and then pay to be assessed by them. And so, you know, they're handing accountability for making these judgments to a lobby group. And, you know, Parliament is signed up to this. The Care Quality Commission, which is the regulator that, you know, assesses safety in healthcare and care settings, is signed up to this. The Crown Prosecution Service that decides who goes to court is signed up to this. So although we have fairly decent law, we have all of this guidance that's being pushed by this outside organisation. And so that then, you know, affected, I think, the environment in which my judgment was made.
So through lawfare, I guess, is one way to combat this. But the social impact of these lobby groups, so there's the lobbying that happens, or the activism, I guess, that happens on Twitter and social media that has a pressure, very strong pressure, because they're pretty lockstep and very thorough when they make an enemy, and they're pretty wild out there. And then there's these lobby groups like Stonewall, etc., that are shaping like businesses and codes of conduct and speech codes, and you know, so there's this top down pressure and this bottom up pressure, and there's these two fronts. In order to what? In order, I'm using a war metaphor, but what is ultimately the goal? What is the, is there a middle ground here? What is the ultimate pursuit that you have ideologically in kind of the bigger picture beyond your suit and through your activism?
I mean, I think the middle ground has to be that everyone has human rights, and we build a society that that accommodates people. You know, it sort of goes back to J.K. Rowling's tweet, sort of wear what you like, call yourself what you like, you know, have sex with whoever will have you. These things in your private life you should be able to do and you should not be discriminated against. But redefining reality and forcing other people to pretend to be part of that is too much, and it breaks all of our institutions. And so I think, you know, the war, the end game, what we want is to have institutions that work, that deal with evidence, that deal with rules, that are fair to people, and that don't engage in these witch hunts. And, you know, and we know, the Salem witch trials, or the Cultural Revolution in China, the institutions get caught up in these
purity spirals.
Yeah, purity spirals and kind of power games. And we know that most of the institutions that are pushing this stuff are not doing it for the benefit of trans people, but they've become caught up in a survival game themselves, where their money, their influence, their own personal status depends on surviving in that game. And then there's a whole group of people whose survival depends on keeping their head down, and, you know, sort of hoping that it'll pass them by. And then there's a small minority of people who speak up. I think the biggest thing that the biggest concern about what it's breaking in the UK is safeguarding. So we have a safeguarding is sort of child protection of vulnerable people, risk assessment in organizations, how you make sure that that predators don't have access to vulnerable children. And that whole process of breaking an organization, of making people scared to speak the truth, of having a bulk of people who keep their head down even when they know that bad things are happening, breaks all of that stuff, which we've had so many lessons from sports, scouts, the Catholic Church, all of these places where institutions have protected themselves rather than protect the vulnerable. And so, for me, the reason I'm doing this is because I think those institutions matter. We can't do without them. We can't give in to the mob. And I think we have a opportunity to save them, to fight for them. We're doing it kind of through, as you say, through lawfare, but also through helping people using the laws that we've got, because most of them are not bad, giving better guidance about what the law really says, and then trying to expose where these organizations have overtaken public institutions, and trying to hold them to account for doing their job instead of doing the job of the lobbyists.
Well, on that front, are you engaged with particular organizations, or do you promote particular organizations that are doing this, networks of people? Is there some sort of nascent institution that is the umbrella for all these things?
So, well, I don't know about umbrella. Umbrella's a dangerous word anyway these days.
Oh, is it? Okay, I'm sorry. Call that in Britain? A trolley? No. A lift? I don't know.
So we launched Sex Matters about a month ago, beginning of March. Sex Matters is a nonpartisan, single-issue campaign focused on bringing back clarity about sex in law, policy and culture, mainly focused in the UK, at least in the first instance, because this is where we are and because there's an opportunity here. But as I said, I think that will help other places too. There is a whole cluster of organisations that have grown up around this in the UK. So I can't remember who all you've probably spoken to most of them.
I'm getting around. Actually, there's others that I have to respond to get them back on.
Yeah. So Women's Place UK, which has come from the left, Fair Play for Women that had, you know, did the census judicial review and did a lot of the campaigning around the Gender Recognition Act. There are groups aligned to every political party. There are groups in Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland. And there are groups that are focused on particular issues, so schools, safeguarding, sports, lesbian and gay rights, and so on. And we want to be the sort of lowest common denominator, the foundation for that, that whatever it is that is driving people to think that this is important, the very basic thing that that's built on is being able to say that sex is real and sex matters, and mm-hmm. whether someone's motivation comes from their religious belief or their non-religious belief or their belief in liberalism or their feminism or their left-wing politics, I don't think it matters. Underlying that is the basic fabric of reality, and that's what we're working on, and then particularly the law and helping people to use the law.
So is there a website, is that found, sexmatters.co or something, UK or something, org? Okay.
Sex -matters.org.
All right.
Not hyphen, but line, whatever it's called.
There's this is a larger story, but just like in interviewing a number of women in your position, it seems like this particular issue has awakened this dormant network of womanhood on the British Isles in some way. There's some sort of tradition or some sort of historical significance to this, in that it's reflecting back previously. I just get that feeling, but I don't know enough about women's history in the UK to really see if that intuition's correct or not. But
there's
a reason you're called Turf Island. That's all
I'm
trying to say.
Yes, yes. And I've kind of thought about why it is we're called Turf Island. I think it's partly that we had a front row seat to what was going on in the US and Canada, because of the language, we could see it. And then I think it's partly because we have the National Health Service. So I think people don't feel quite so scared about losing their job. No, I mean, not that people want to lose their job, but if they'd made Breaking Bad in the UK, it would have been a really boring series because he would have got treated.
That no thing motivation of, like,
you lose your job and you die.
Yeah.
So I think there's that of being in a country with a still slightly functioning social safety net,
There's just something in the character. There's just something in the character that I just see.
Yeah, being taking no shit. I don't know. And then, it grew up a lot on Mumsnet. So it was, older women who had, you start work and you think that the battles have been won, that you live in a basically equal society. I think a lot of educated women, and then you have a baby, and then you sort of go back to the 50s. You realize that the doors that had been opened are suddenly closed, and you become an invisible person, and yet you still have the same brain and the same ambitions and same broader concerns beyond nappies and baby food, but you're suddenly confined to this very small world that is hard to get back out of. So Mumsnet, UK Mums Forum is, as they say, radicalized on Mumsnet. It's this sort of forum of feminist activism and radical reawakening of women who've sort of woken up in their 40s and realized that things were not as fair as they'd been sold in their 20s. And I don't know if in the US that is quite the same group, but it's,
there's,
you know,
probably there's so many different overlapping cultures in the US, and we're much more spread out than you guys.
And I think, you know, we're much smaller. We don't really have a particularly religious, you know, religion is not a big political force in the way that it is in the US, so that we don't have that kind of polarization. And then, you know, it has come from the left in the UK. The resistance to this has come from trade union women and women on the left.
Do you have any parting wisdom that you've derived from this particular chapter of your adventurous life?
Never apologize. I mean, obviously apologize if you did something wrong, but don't apologize for something. You know, don't apologize because you think it will save your skin, because it won't. You're better off standing up if you can.
Okay. And how have you adapted to the negative attention that your exposure has gotten you? Or how do you deal with that? Are there tips for that?
No, well, you know, it's probably quite unhealthy. I mean, you know, you get called a Nazi every day, and it starts to become normal, and that's not good in itself. That, you know,
it's an odd form of, it's not Holocaust denial, it's Holocaust erasure, actually, by throwing that term around so much.
Yeah, and, you know, you sort of cope with it by saying these people are idiots, but it desensitizes you to, you know, to what's happening to you and what's happening to other people. But, you know, I've met the best people, as President Trump would say. No, you know, I think when these kind of things happen, when this challenges face you and you see who it is that stands up for you, or who it is that stands up for what they believe and for the truth, and who it is that, you know, keeps their head down and keeps an eye on their pension. It's sort of filtered out the good people, or the interesting people. And I've been so disappointed by the institutions and by the people who should have been holding the space for public debate on this. The lack of integrity in public institutions has been quite shocking, and in some ways that, you know, sort of upsets me more than idiots on Twitter who are probably the age of my children, and, you know, sitting in their basement and so on.
Yeah. So I really thank you for exposing yourself to me. I like the, I feel like I got a glimpse of like the core values. And I think that they align up with what we're calling classical liberalism, like this integrity towards reality and then an integrity towards navigating reality through society and through the substructure of clear, rigorous debate as our way toward the truth and toward the good, and et cetera. Once those things go, all that's left is power and madness. So it's, you know, whether you come down one way or the other on the specifics of trans rights or transgenderism, it's the using of those or hiding behind those in certain currents, not every single one, but in certain currents, being kind of that under the cover of rights is coming this assault on how we actually function healthily as a society and efficiently.
Yeah,
there's kind of like this thing that you have to kind of look through.
And that's what's worth fighting for. I mean, it's not, you know, fighting against, you know, the noise on Twitter is, I mean, it would be easier just to turn Twitter off, but it, it's what it's done to our institutions that is worth fighting for.
Well, thank you for fighting.
That I'll keep doing it. I've got the appeal is on the 27th and 28th of April, so we're appealing. Okay. Yes, coming up, appealing against the judgment. So sexmatters.org on Twitter will be live tweeting that if people want to follow it.
Do you have like that tweet framed in your house somewhere, the JK yeah. Rowling tweet?
Well,
and do you change
it,
the number of likes on it every day? You check
it? No, because it stresses my husband out too much, but I have had it blown up, and I gave copies to my lawyers to put up in their offices.
You should make a t-shirt to raise funds.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd like a t-shirt that says worthy of respect in a democratic society, but got to wait for a judgment that says that.
Got to wait for the magistrate to come down.
Anyway, this is my t-shirt today.
Oh, there we go.
I've got,
excellent,
you know, a wide range of t-shirts.
You UKGC women do like your t-shirts and your billboards.
Yeah, I wasn't really a t-shirt wearer before all of this.
This stuff turns the darndest people into activists. You'd never think that you were that. And all of a sudden you're standing up on principle.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you, Maya, for your story and letting me interview you. I asked you way back in the beginning, but you had to work in the shadows for a while. So thank you for remembering my offer and letting us get a glimpse into the ins and outs of what you're going through.
Thank you. It's been fun.
I'm going to end the recording there.
Okay.
Congratulations for reaching the end of the discussion. If you enjoyed it, do be sure to leave a review or a comment or a thumbs up or whatever you need to do to show that glorious algorithm that this is some good stuff. And do be sure to go and check that back catalog, as it is brimming full of fantastic conversations. Links to provide monetary support are down there in the description as well. Have a good night.